ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the opposition leader Angus Taylor announces his migration plan to protect Australian values. Also, Donald Trump again vows to destroy vessels that try to breach the US blockade of Iranian ports. And Prince Harry and Meghan are back in Australia with police protection courtesy of the taxpayer.
I don't think it could be said that it's a waste of money, because putting aside whether you like them or not, and this goes for anyone in society, there is a duty of care by the state to protect these individuals.
The federal opposition leader Angus Taylor has today announced the first part of what he's calling his Australian values migration plan. Mr. Taylor says the nation is at risk of having its culture eroded by migrants who refuse to accept Australian values. And to counter that, he's planning to bolster the screening of prospective migrants, including by checking their social media posts. Australia's Race Discrimination Commissioner is warning the plan and Mr. Taylor's rhetoric could incite racism, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Angus Taylor says his top priorities as opposition leader are to improve living standards and to protect the Australian way of life. And for him, that starts with immigration.
We must dispense with the naive thinking that has dominated our immigration policy for too long. Our nation has paid the price for believing that anyone from anywhere will embrace our way of life. Not everyone wanting to migrate to Australia has a noble intent. Not everyone wanting to migrate to Australia will be a net benefit to Australia. Indeed, some will be a net drain.
In a speech to the Menzies Research Centre, a Liberal Party-affiliated think tank, Mr. Taylor outlined the first phase of the Coalition's new immigration policy.
Australia has a non-discriminatory immigration program. We don't discriminate based on nationality, race, gender, or faith. But for an immigration program to work in the national interest, it must discriminate based on values.
As part of his immigration plan, Angus Taylor says the pledge migrants sign to uphold Australian values should be legally binding, and he says there should be increased scrutiny on the social media activity of visa applicants to identify radical or extremist content. Mr. Taylor says people from liberal democracies are more likely to assimilate into Australia than people from authoritarian countries. He also singled out Palestinian refugees who've arrived from war-torn Gaza as a threat.
The Gazan cohort of 1,700 people here on visas presents a high risk to our nation.
Dr. Graham Tom is the Advocacy Coordinator at the Refugee Council of Australia.
To single out people who have been so highly traumatised and are so grateful for the safety that they've been afforded in Australia is really so disappointing. It's shameful, in fact. It's absolutely shameful.
Dr. Tom says it's both harmful and wrong to suggest that Palestinian refugees should face a higher level of scrutiny.
The only people who are able to get out were close family members. We're talking about family here of Australian citizens and Australian residents. We're talking about somebody's wife, somebody's children, somebody's elderly grandmother being able to get to safety and reunite with family here. And again, in order to do that, they have had to be vetted by at least three governments. That vetting has included their social media. It is still including their social media. So this is one of the most scrutinised groups ever to be allowed to come to Australia.
Giridharan Sivaraman is Australia's Race Discrimination Commissioner.
I was disappointed to see a continuation of dehumanisation of migrants, which is something that's happening at all levels of politics. I was disappointed with condemning an entire Palestinian population that sought asylum here and are clearly escaping horrors in Gaza. And I was disappointed at this introduction of this idea of a test based on a vague notion of Australian values with an implicit meaning that people from some countries shouldn't be admitted into Australia.
He says the policy is discriminatory and the language is divisive.
If political rhetoric dehumanises migrants, we will see an increase in racism towards migrants. And often the only signal as to whether someone is a migrant is the colour of their skin, their name, or their accent.
The coalition policy includes measures to reduce the number of unfounded visa protection claims and increase funding to deport people who are in the country illegally. There's also a promise to increase funding to vet visa applicants who pose a threat to Australia. Angus Taylor has also promised to drastically cut the number of migrants arriving to Australia as part of a broader immigration policy to be revealed at a later date.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. For analysis of the opposition leader's Australian Values Migration Plan, I spoke to Associate Professor Paul Williams, a political commentator at Griffith University in Brisbane.
Look, I think they're probably the boldest comments we've heard from an opposition or indeed government on restricting immigration or cracking down immigration, which way you want to frame it. We've probably heard probably since John Howard's comments in the 1980s, which inevitably cost him the leadership when he allegedly wanted to see some sort of change in migration in order to keep the Australian tempo of what Australia had been used to. And from then on, up until One Nation, or certainly even after One Nation, it's been bipartisan between the government opposition, notwithstanding the issue around refugees around the early 2000s. But generally, in terms of just general migration program, I think these are probably the harshest, most conservative comments that we've seen in 40 years from a major party. And it really, I think, changes the game. I think it changes the tempo of the immigration debate.
So what's motivating Angus Taylor and the Liberal Party to come out with this policy? Is it the rise of One Nation?
Yeah, look, most of it you could sheet home to the rise of One Nation. I mean, in poll after poll, it's pretty much for most of this year, the coalition is actually polling a primary vote lower than One Nation's primary vote. Now, we've never seen a minor party eclipse a major party, government or opposition, really since modern polling began. And the problem particularly is for the coalition is that almost all of One Nation's new votes are coming from the coalition. Labor's primary vote is still around 30%. It's not really being dented much by One Nation.
So do you think that this immigration plan that Angus Taylor has announced today will appeal to people who normally vote Liberal but are moving to One Nation or attempted to?
Look, I think it's designed to potentially appeal to those voters. He knows that in order to undercut the One Nation vote, he needs to take his gloves off and get real. And importantly, however, he also needs to do something to take Labor off the boil. He needs to do something to take the fight up to Labor. So I noticed that Mr. Taylor's comments are really wrapped up also in an attack on the Labor Party, which is really quite clever rhetoric from his point of view. He's just not talking about immigration in a vacuum. He's talking about immigration being a lazy way to promote economic growth, and the Albanese government's economic growth has come only from immigration. That's the allegation. So it's quite a clever attack.
We know, though, that for the coalition to win government, they're going to have to win back a lot of those Liberal seats in inner urban areas in Sydney and Melbourne. Is this sort of policy, this hardline immigration plan, going to appeal to voters in those seats, some of which have turned teal?
We've got to untangle, I suppose, the issues. And the issue that won't win those seats back for the Liberals, you know, the North Shore of Sydney or leafing Melbourne or leafing Brisbane, that's the issue of climate change. So the coalition really doesn't have much credibility among those inner city voters who want to vote green or teal in the capital cities on climate change. So immigration is a little bit different because pretty much everyone is affected by the housing crisis. Anyone who has a mortgage or anyone who rents, we're all affected by the housing crisis. It's only those who are, you know, own their own homes. So it's really a question of the way that that issue is framed. So if the coalition can successfully frame and link the issue of housing affordability and supply, if they can frame it as directly linked to immigration pressures, then they might be able to sell and cut through. But again, the way that Angus framed it today, he's just not framed it on raw numbers. He's actually framed it around Australian values, which again is a step further and a step further than we've seen most other party leaders go. to what type of migrant that Australia is looking for in terms of values and belief. And you're quite right, may backfire and see the potential Labor, Green or Teal voter stay right away from the coalition in the inner cities.
Dr. Williams, Angus Taylor referred today to both the United States and the UK in terms of immigration. He suggested the wave of migration there is changing the character of those nations. How do you reflect on that international aspect to today's announcement from Angus Taylor? Is he trying to draw on that sort of nationalistic movement in those countries?
Oh, look, I really do think so. I think he's echoing that sort of politics and that sort of rhetoric. So that really is almost like a dog whistle to those Australians who are frightened of cultural change. And certainly we saw it to great effect in the United States. You know, Donald Trump was elected largely over migration and America's cultural identity more than an economic argument. And certainly we've seen the rise of Nigel Farage and the hard right and indeed the far right. In Britain, over similar problems, and many European countries as well have had the same problem with the far right, the populist right, and it's some people have actually said that, you know, Australia's just playing catch up. We probably should have had our rise of the far right maybe a decade ago, and we're just slow to catch up.
Associate Professor Paul Williams from Griffith Uni in Brisbane. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. To the latest from the Middle East, and the US Navy is now blockading Iranian ports, and the President Donald Trump is again warning that any Iranian ships that approach will be destroyed. With the Strait of Hormuz still closed to most vessels, Australia is joining a summit hosted by France and the UK later this week to discuss safeguarding shipping in the crucial passage in the event a lasting peace deal is reached. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has confirmed he'll be involved in peace talks between Israel and Lebanon, but the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah is already flagging it won't abide by any agreement. Rachel Hayter filed this report.
La ilaha illallah!
Thousands of Iranians chant in the capital Tehran, condemning the American military for preventing ships from entering or leaving Iranian ports.
Right now we have a blockade. They're doing no business.
Halfway through a fragile two-week ceasefire with Iran, the US President Donald Trump claims the action will force Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and back to the negotiating table.
I didn't like seeing boats come out if they were doing business with Iran. So now Iran is doing absolutely no business, and we're going to keep it that way.
Any vessel entering or leaving the blockaded area without authorization will be subject to interception, diversion, and capture by the US military.
It will prove difficult for the US to enforce.
Siddharth Kaushal is a Sea Power Research Fellow from defence and security think tank, the Royal United Services Institute.
A lot depends on the early days of the blockade, how many vessels the Americans can seize, how much they can convince vessels attempting to slip through a cordon that they're likely to be seized.
A number of European countries are distancing themselves from the US blockade on Iranian maritime traffic, including the United Kingdom.
We, the UK, will not be joining blockade that the President announced.
Prime Minister Keir Starmer reiterating that joining the war in the Middle East is not in the United Kingdom's national interest.
We are focusing our efforts on opening in full the Strait of Hormuz because of the damage it's doing to economies around the world, including our own economy. That is why we've been working with other countries at various levels, and we'll bring them together in a summit later this week.
Australia will attend that summit of more than 40 nations, which is being co-hosted by the UK and France.
There's a coalition of nations that are really keen to see a diplomatic resolution of the conflict and for the Strait to be reopened via diplomatic means.
Minister for Defence Industry Pat Conroy says any Australian-supported action in the Strait of Hormuz will only happen once the war is over.
There's a variety of potential threats in Australia that people have identified. I think the key thing is that these 40 nations are coming together to discuss options, but we need peace in that region first.
There are reports Iran has laid mines in the strait and it's trying to charge fees on ships passing through. About 20,000 seafarers on 1,600 vessels are still stranded in and around the Strait of Hormuz.
Imagine being in a situation where you've been trapped on board the ship without being able to navigate for over a month now.
Arsenio Dominguez is the International Maritime Organization's Secretary General.
There's always the concerns that supplies may start running low. There's the constant threat that a ship may be targeted or attacked.
Mediators from Pakistan, Egypt and Turkey are working to revive negotiations between the United States and Iran before the current ceasefire expires in a week's time. Talks between Israeli and Lebanese ambassadors to the US are scheduled for Washington later today. But Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah has already flagged it won't abide by any agreements. Its Secretary General is Naeem Qassem.
Because there is no solution to this aggression other than to either surrender or fight. We will never surrender.
The Israel-Lebanon talks will be hosted by US top diplomat Marco Rubio.
Rachel Hayter, as the price of jet fuel continues to soar because of the Middle East conflict, Qantas has today announced it'll temporarily suspend 4 regional air services. Flights on another route will be put on hold indefinitely. Aviation experts are warning this could be just the beginning of ongoing disruptions to Australia's flight networks. Samantha Johncher filed this story.
People in the Northern Territory are used to feeling far away from the East Coast. But in the Darwin Departures Lounge, there's concern it's about to get even harder to fly out of the top end after Qantas announced it'll suspend its Darwin to Gold Coast flights.
Anything can happen. I think that's the big worry, is there's a certain amount of uncertainty that will affect, the Northern Territory as a whole. And that will also impact charters, medical flights, community flights.
Qantas says it will be cutting 5% of its domestic seats in response to what the airline forecasts is an $800 million increase on its jet fuel bill for the first 6 months of this year. The majority of these cuts will be to off-peak flights between major cities. There's also the temporary suspension of 4 regional routes. And Qantas will permanently axe its flight between Mount Gambier and Adelaide, citing low demand and rising costs. David Leaney is an energy supply chain expert at ANU.
All flights have an economic viability to them. Some flights are more profitable than others, and they'll be looking at, what can we do to cut our least profitable flight? So what they're doing basically is they're lining up all of their flights from most profitable to least profitable and saying, what can we do?
The suspensions begin on May 18, which David Leaney says is probably the earliest Qantas could make significant network changes.
They've got to log flight plans. There's certain things that are requirements for aviation management across the network. So it takes some time to do all the fine tuning of that.
David Leaney warns that Australia's jet fuel supply chain could prove harder to manage than petrol and diesel supplies. Australia gets most of its petrol from Singapore, most of its diesel from South Korea, and most of its jet fuel from China. While Australia can bring its natural gas to the bargaining table with Singapore and South Korea, it doesn't have nearly as much leverage in China.
China's a bit more complicated because with all of the others, we've got this great leverage point of our natural gas exports. We don't quite have the same leverage point over China. And China also has a very big requirement for domestic use. So they've said to the world, hey, everybody, as jet fuel starts to get tight, we're going to prioritise our own domestic use. And that means that we've got to look for alternate jet fuel providers.
The federal government isn't the only authority trying to shore up supplies. Today, the West Australian Premier, Roger Cook, announced he had secured 4 million litres of diesel for his state, separate from the national stockpile.
It will be 100% owned by the state. It is a strategic stockpile to really target acute localised shortages. But in particular, it will support our remote communities and key industries such as agriculture, which rely heavily on uncontracted fuel volumes.
Hussein Dia is a transport technology expert at Swinburne University.
This really highlights both the role and limits of government action. Governments cannot create new fuel supply in the short term, but they can manage it more effectively, securing supply through international agreements, encouraging demand reduction, and ensuring these critical sectors are given priorities. Airlines, however, operate commercially, and I think they will continue to make independent decisions.
These experts both expect other airlines to follow Qantas's lead and trim their flight schedules as costs continue to rise.
Samantha Johncher with that report. Prince Harry and his wife Meghan are back in Australia for the first time since their royal tour of 2018. No longer working members of the royal family, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex are here this time in a private capacity. Their four-day itinerary includes charity events and paid appearances at functions. And as the pair works to earn a living, it seems many Australians aren't happy the taxpayer is footing some of their security bill. Kimberly Price prepared this report.
In 2018, newlyweds the Duke and Duchess of Sussex touched down in Australia for a whirlwind tour. The trip was largely seen as a success for the popular couple. But in the almost 8 years that have followed, much has changed for Prince Harry and his wife Meghan.
Buckingham Palace has confirmed that the Duke and Duchess of Sussex will not be returning as working members of the royal family.
How do you feel about the palace hearing you speak your truth today?
I don't know how they could expect that after all of this time, we would still just be silent.
I think spare, when that released, I think that was the end for Harry's reputation as a serious man.
Now the Sussexes have returned to Australia, where they will attend a range of private meetings and commercial functions, including visiting charities aligned with their focus on mental health, community resilience and support for veterans and their families. The Duchess will also speak at a luxury wellness event, where tickets cost a minimum of almost $2,700. Today, patients lined up to meet the couple during their visit to Melbourne's Royal Children's Hospital.
He asked me how the care was and had to point out how gorgeous and lovely our nurses are and how they take such good care of us.
Well, Meghan wished me to keep on being brave and I gave Harry some flowers. I was just grateful for the opportunity to meet them.
Juliet Reardon is ABC's royal correspondent.
They're coming here because they were invited to two private events, which each of them are speaking, and they built this sort of tour around that. My bigger question is why they do that, why they build these semi-royal tours around what are private events. Why don't they just go, if they want to go and visit charities, why don't they just do that privately?
Part of the polarisation around the Duke and Duchess's trip to Australia are concerns about taxpayer money spent on extra police protection reported by some media outlets. An online petition has garnered over 46,000 signatures demanding that their visit is given no taxpayer funding. The Victorian and New South Wales Police say some additional security measures will be put in place while the Duke and Duchess of Sussex visit. Dr. Vincent Hurley is a criminologist at Macquarie University. He says that any additional police resources, which cost taxpayers, go through rigorous consideration.
There would be a risk assessment done by the New South Wales Police or the Victorian Police. So what is the risk of them being targeted for, you know, for hate or for someone being, you know, who was stalking them?
Vincent Hurley says those risk assessments are then given a rating by authorities and passed on to the state government.
There would be a minister in the state government that would be overseeing this, and that could well be the police minister. And the police minister might make a decision that, yes, the expenditure of the police resources is appropriate for this length of time for these reasons, or they might reject it.
After stepping back from royal duties, it was decided that Prince Harry and his family's security in the United Kingdom would be assessed on a case-by-case basis. He challenged that ruling in the High Court and lost. Prince Harry then said he could not safely return to the UK with his family. Vincent Hurley says his status as a fifth in line to the throne would be a serious consideration for the police proving security.
Putting aside that whether you like them or not, there is a duty of care by the state to protect these individuals.
The Duke and Duchess of Sussex will also visit Sydney and Canberra during their four-day tour.
Kimberly Price with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on ABC Listen. And that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning too. PM will be back at the same time tomorrow. I hope you have a very good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The peace talks failed, so now Donald Trump wants to disrupt the vital oil shipping route, the Strait of Hormuz, even further. A US blockade will stop ships entering or departing Iranian ports. Today, Hussein Abish from the Arab Gulf States Institute on what to expect. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.